Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. I'm glad you've tuned in today. You know, it's been almost 2 years since the city of Seattle declared a state of emergency on homelessness, and still the number of homeless people in the city has kept rising. My next guest has an idea. City Council member Mike O'Brien wants to pay for homelessness programs with a new head tax on Seattle businesses. It would be a yearly $100 tax on every employee working at big revenue businesses like Amazon and Starbucks. Councilmember O'Brien, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
Why a head tax on big businesses?
Well, the reason why we need any revenue source is because we're in this housing and homelessness crisis. And as you mentioned, we're 2 years into this state of emergency around homelessness. And yet, despite some good investments and some good work being done, every year we find that the problem is actually worse than it was when we declared the state of emergency. That demands that we do something significant to reduce the crisis that we're in. And I think something of the magnitude of $25 million a year split between investments in affordable housing and homeless outreach and shelter opportunities for folks living on the street is about what it's going to take to not solve the problem, but at least start reducing the problem we're seeing. And we don't have a lot of great tools for raising revenue in the city. The state limits what we can do. And so trying to find a tax that is fair. And when I say fair, what I'm looking at is in the last 5 or 6 years, we've generated a lot of wealth in the city. And that's great. That's something to be proud of. And I'd be really proud of it, except for the fact that at the same time, we're also creating a lot more poverty.
Doesn't that growth bring in revenues by itself and sales tax and real estate excise taxes? And is it not paying for itself?
It's doing some, but it's not covering it all.
Okay.
And part of the problem is, you know, we have lagging stuff we're working on. You know, to bring our transportation infrastructure up to this new level of employment and growth is, you know, a 10, 20 years of investments that we have to do that we haven't done for the last two decades. And when it comes to homelessness, you know, one of the factors of this growth that's happening in, you know, companies like Amazon who are bringing in high-wage workers to our community, which is a good thing, but it's driving the cost of housing up. And despite our building thousands and thousands of new units of housing every year, we cannot keep up.
Okay. I want to talk about how you would spend this money in a moment. First of all, Seattle mayoral candidate Carrie Moon has this problem with the head tax idea. She says she agrees with you. Big businesses like Amazon should pay more.
So I believe in what it is trying to fund. I don't think they did the math right yet on how to charge the tax. I think it needs to be just on the 10% biggest businesses in our city. And, you know, for $5 million, if you are a business like a grocery store or a retail shop that does fairly high sales volume with a very low profit margin, you would get caught up in that $5 million threshold. So I think we need to change the math so it's just larger businesses above a certain size. So maybe of employees above a certain size.
One of the Seattle businesses echoing that concern is Bartell Drugs. George Bartell says, quote, millions might not be much for Amazon and Starbucks or the city. It's definitely a big deal for us. And with a head tax and our warehouse and headquarters both located in the city, we will face costs our competitors won't. So Councilmember O'Brien, are you targeting businesses that you really don't want to target?
Well, we're trying to be as delicate as possible in how we target this. You know, state law doesn't give us an unlimited amount of tools, and it's probably not a bad thing. We don't get to say that business and that business, but not this one.
Well, Carrie Moon is saying big employer businesses, not just by revenue, because you could make a lot of money but have a low profit margin.
We could do it that way, too. So one of the issues, you know, that George Bartell brought up, you know, Amazon, we think, would probably pay about $4 million in this. Bartels does not have 40,000 employees in the city of Seattle. So George Bartell would be talking about probably, I don't know their employment level in the city, but I'm guessing more like tens of thousands of dollars, not millions of dollars. And I look at Bartels. It's a great business. It's so exciting to see, you know, in so many new neighborhoods as new construction is happening that Bartels is going as an anchor tenant. But Bartels is growing and benefiting from the growth that's happening in the city. Their competitors are out-of-state competitors. It's great to see Bartels thrive, but someone like CVS or Walgreens are in states where they have an income tax of 5 or 6%. You know, George doesn't have that here. So, you know, if we want to look at equity across the tax system, I think most of us would agree that Washington State has the most unfair tax system, and we're trying to make it a little more fair.
Well, Bartell Drugs is one of many businesses complaining they've reached a breaking point on city-imposed costs like secure scheduling, $15 minimum wage, paid sick leave, etc. How would you know when you've gone too far charging Seattle businesses?
You know, Bill, when I look around the city and see what's going on, one of my roles, at least that I think of as council member, is figure out who should I be out there fighting for. I want a thriving business economy, absolutely. And I'm proud that we have some of these home-based businesses that are doing really well. That's outstanding. And I don't want to punish them in any way for their success. But I look at folks that are struggling, you know, the retired couple on a fixed income whose property taxes keep going up and they're struggling to stay in their housing. You know, the single mom who's trying to buy that winter parka for her school-age kid and is paying higher and higher sales tax on that. And I think I need to find a fair way to fund this crisis we're in. We need more affordable housing. We need more emergency shelter services. And I think there's a bunch of businesses that have made a lot of wealth in the last few years, and I think it's fair to ask them to pay a little bit. The head tax would be 5 cents per hour. So on someone paying minimum wage, that is less than a third of a percent of the labor cost. And for someone who's making more than minimum wage, it's even a smaller percentage. This is not going to dramatically change the balance sheet of some of these companies.
Okay, let's talk about how businesses might react. This big business head tax idea comes right as the city is fretting about being too hard on Amazon, and Amazon's looking for another headquarters. Would a head tax help send Amazon into the arms of another city?
I don't believe so. What makes Seattle a thriving business environment is not that we have the cheapest real estate in the world. It's not that we have the most business-friendly regulations. The reason that businesses choose to live here and the ones that do come here thrive is because we have an environment where the types of workers they need to make their business successful want to live. It's a diverse city. It's got a lot of culture activity going on. It's environmentally beautiful, and we spend money to preserve that. And it's a place, frankly, that people think of as being equitable, not where there's mansions and yachts and thousands of people.
But an Amazon employee who says, you know, I only want to go work for Amazon in a city that has income equity. Is that really how they a company attracts workers?
I think when someone looks at a city like Seattle, they want to be here in part because of what they see on the ground and in part because they want to be in a city that feels fair. And I do, you know, we hear a lot from high-tech workers that say, we love being in Seattle. I know, you know, these folks come and testify all the time. I'm one of those Amazon workers. I'm making good money. I should pay a little more to make this city fair. It's not fair that the older lady down the street is property taxes going up while I'm kicking her out of the community because I'm pricing her out.
Okay, you hear that.
What Amazon wants, what any business wants, they don't want us to be, we don't want to be the cheapest city. We want to be the best city.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean the cheapest.
As for how you would spend the head tax money, you want almost $2 million to help people live in their RVs and cars, is that right?
If so,
is that on residential streets or group lots in industrial areas?
What? So the city right now does not have a strategy around people living in their vehicles. And we think about 40% of our unsheltered population is living in vehicles. So we need a strategy. That's something that I had been pushing the previous mayor to come up with. He tried a couple things that didn't work very well. I think it was an okay attempt, but you don't give up when it fails.
Well, for example, they opened some safe lots that turned out to be massively more expensive than they thought for RVs, and they shut down the Ballard and Interbay sites. Are you talking about trying that again or what?
We need a different model than that. I think one of the things we need to do with people living in vehicles is give some of them places off the streets to be, whether that's city-owned property or something we rent. What we did wrong, I think, with that model is we had 24-hour security that we were paying to be on site. We probably need more of a self-managed model like we do with our sanctioned tent encampments. But we also need just a strategy of who is interacting with folks in vehicles. How do we get them connected to the services? How do we get them out of those vehicles? And they have unique challenges.
You mentioned the tent encampments and it should go to a self-managed model instead of a 24-hour security service. Are you saying that the typical tent encampment is as safe as you want it to be?
the sanctioned tent encampments, I think, are very safe.
Okay.
You know, they, you know, they're members of the community that live there, take turns doing jobs and picking up trash and making sure that the perimeter is safe.
And so when people are thinking about dangerous places, they're probably thinking about the unsanctioned tent areas that they can see pop up, or people being under the freeway.
Yeah, you look at
the jungle,
the sanctioned sites like the Nicholsville site in Ballard, and everyone, just about everyone in the community that I talked to today, even some that were upset at the beginning, feel like this is they're good neighbors.
Yeah. Okay.
Let me just say really quickly though, on the tax, it would raise, we think, about $24 million, and the proposal is about three quarters of that, about $18 million, would go towards permanent housing solutions. We need more affordable housing for folks at lower income levels to get into. And then about a quarter of it, about $6 million a year, would go to emergency shelter and outreach work. So part of that would be expanding the LEED program to North Seattle. That's a law enforcement diversion program that's been very successful in downtown Seattle, but we could expand that. And then the other $5 million or so would be for emergency shelter options, which could include things like safe vehicles lots, could be more sanctioned tent encampments. It could be more navigation centers or other types of 24-hour emergency shelter.
Are those vehicles in industrial areas, on residential, you know, right alongside homes, or what?
So right now, if you have an RV, an oversized vehicle, you can only park overnight in industrial areas.
Yeah, so this is not involving cars along the street. We hear about this, right?
Right.
Ballard and...
So there's no proposal to change where they can park.
Okay.
We just need to have a strategy that says these folks are living in a vehicle. Our laws are not particularly flexible to that, and kicking them out of the vehicle makes everyone's life worse. So let's have a strategy.
Okay. I'm talking with City Council member, Seattle City Council member Mike O'Brien, who also is interested in studying congestion pricing. You want the city to study the idea of tolling surface streets to make drivers pay for clogging our city at rush hour. Why is that a good idea for Seattle?
Well, so the thing that causes me the most concern is that in about a year and a half, the deep bore tunnel will be open to vehicular traffic, and WashDOT intends to toll that tunnel to help pay for that billion-dollar project. The tolls on that tunnel, the models show us, will divert tens of thousands of vehicles out of the tunnel onto city streets. And at rush hour, when our streets and I-5 are already at capacity, those tolls and the diversion it creates have the potential to create havoc with our downtown streets. We have been discussing this challenge with WashDOT for a while. We're anxious to get to a resolution of it, but we need to make sure that the traffic in downtown doesn't get so gridlocked, specifically for the buses that accommodate the vast majority of people that are commuting to downtown. If those are stuck in traffic, it'll be catastrophic. This study would look at who is currently driving to and from downtown, try to understand some of the demographics of them, try to understand, are these people that have good transit options and just aren't taking them? Are these people that don't have good transit options because of either the time of day or the type of work they're doing or where they live? So the actual study is really more demographic data about who's driving.
Okay.
And that will help inform how we react to WashDOT tolling of the tunnel.
Here is a concern about congestion pricing from this week's mayoral debate, candidate Carrie Moon.
Congestion pricing puts too much burden on low-income folks, especially folks who have to drive for work or folks who are not well served by transit because they're in a low-income neighborhood, they don't have political power, they don't have much voice, they don't have transit. We absolutely have to get the transit in place before we can consider something like congestion pricing.
Could you somehow means test congestion pricing, or is it just, hey, it's a user fee, you use it, you pay for it?
Well, so part of the study is to try to understand how big of a problem that is. I mean, let's be clear, driving and parking downtown today is not something that's affordable to most people. And so we absolutely, if we do a tolling scheme in Seattle at some point, and I should step back just to say, we are a long ways from doing anything like this. For the city to toll city streets would require us to go to a vote of the people of Seattle. Before the council would send something to the vote, we would want to feel pretty confident that we have a system that the public would support. I'm not even aware of a system that I support right now without more data. So we're talking about a long conversation. But we want to do some. If we do something, we want it to be equitable. And understanding who's currently driving downtown, who might be able to afford to pay tolls, who could switch to transit, and who can't, would allow us to design a system that is fair and equitable, as Carrie Moon mentioned.
As you're figuring this out, Councilmember O'Brien, here's a story. You know who tried congestion pricing? Stockholm, Sweden. And here is how it worked out. This is State Transportation Commission Director Mark Hallenbeck telling the story of Swedish congestion pricing.
Stockholm put a ring around the city, and you had to drive in, and they took all the money and put lots of transit service. And they said, we're going to do this as a 6-month test, and then you get to vote. And they did the test. Everybody inside Stockholm was happy. Everybody outside Stockholm who was driving in was pissed. They voted.
How about that?
They voted no. All the people in charge lost, right? They were out. Mm. The next group came in and said, well, how about this version? We're going to put this toll ring around and all the money that gets spent goes to the suburbs. And the people who lived inside Stockholm who liked the traffic going away and the better bus service voted yes. The people who got the money in the far suburbs voted yes.
Huh.
And the people who paid to drive into the city voted no. And the two groups who liked it outvoted the people who didn't like it.
So, Councilmember O'Brien, by that logic, this should be a King County or regional program to congestion price Seattle and then send that money to the suburbs.
Well, the message I take away from...
I don't think you're in the business of sending money to the suburbs.
The message I took away from that, and what we heard, what London did too, because they have a similar cordon pricing system, is it requires a massive investment in transit. You have to give people alternatives to get downtown that are reliable. And so if Seattle were to go down this path at some point, and again, that is likely years away, we would want to make sure that we have the transit in place so that the vast majority of folks that are currently driving have a good alternative. Nobody likes tolling. In fact, the only thing that I think people may like less than tolling is getting stuck in traffic. And so these two things are kind of at odds with each other, and we're going to try to figure it out.
And on congestion pricing and on your big business employee head tax, what's going to happen next? What should listeners, just very briefly, know? What stage is this at?
So the budget is in process right now, and the city council will continue to deliberate over the next 2 to 3 weeks.
They're still taking public comment?
Still taking public comment. Okay. There's a public hearing the first week in November. I think it's November 1st, but I'm not positive on that, in the evening.
Okay.
The head tax will be resolved one way or the other by the time we approve the final budget on November 20th.
Okay, this is okay.
And the budget includes a $200,000 item to study who's driving downtown.
Right.
I anticipate that will be part of the budget. That is not any sort of proxy on whether we're going to do congestion pricing again. That is years away.
But
what is going to happen is the state's going to be tolling that tunnel, and that's going to have an impact on downtown Seattle. That's coming.
City Councilmember Mike O'Brien just told you what he knows. Tell him what you think, and the rest of the council as well. This is Mike O'Brien, who's been talking with us on KUOW's The Record. Good to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
It's The Record, KUOW Seattle. And coming up, if you feel like you're being priced out by these high-paid tech jobs, why don't you train yourself up and go get one of those tech jobs? We'll talk about whether there is joy in coding coming up. KUOW's The Record. As we were just discussing, Seattle's getting harder to afford. Here's one way to afford it. Get one of those tech jobs you read about, right? Does that sound inspiring, boring, expensive? Is learning to code just what you got to do to feed yourself, or is there joy in coding? Lissa Walzer is a former biologist who became a software developer at Redfin through a software boot camp. And Sherry Allen is a photographer turned engineer who teaches coding. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Hello.
First, I think we should define our terms. When we say coding, learning to code, Lissa, what do we mean?
We usually mean writing software that is used various places. Most of the boot camps focus on websites or apps that are on your smartphone.
Writing software. So, Sherry, my kids at school, they have this website called Lightbot, and the kids have to write in the instructions to tell the little cute robot when to turn left and right and walk forward and jump up and jump down and light up the squares. Are those instructions, is that coding?
It absolutely is, yeah. At the most basic level, writing software is writing a set of instructions that some computer is going to execute for you. And robotics is the most fun way to start because you get to see a little guy move.
It is awfully cute.
Yep. But then it gets a little more complicated from there. But you're still just writing instructions.
Okay. So as you just heard, as everyone just heard, I'm pretty clueless. I have an elementary, I have my 7-year-old's understanding of coding. So one question I have is, let's say I were to quit this job tomorrow and said, you know, I gotta learn to code. That's how I'm gonna feed my family. How long do you think it would take before I could, okay, now I know enough to have a new career, Sherry?
The people I've seen, either through teaching or through mentoring, it tends to be about a 1-year process if they're not going to go to university for a computer science degree. And it starts out with learning on their own. There are a million resources online and they're free. And starting with those free resources, teaching yourself a little something and finding out if you like it is the first step. And then from there, there are a lot of more formal programs from universities, community colleges, and boot camps, of course.
And Lissa, what you went through one of these boot camps. What kind of potential jobs are we talking about? Help me envision this field I might be getting into.
Most of the jobs are in internet software companies. There are more recognizable ones like Amazon. Redfin is the one that I'm at. And then there are also a lot of smaller startups that you don't hear about, but that still employ people. And those are usually very small places, maybe, you know, 1 to 5 employees.
Okay, so Redfin, you're at Redfin. This is real estate. And you're using your coding to do what when you go to work? What are you building or writing?
Well, the whole idea of Redfin is that we're a technology-powered company. So we build a lot of software that helps either customers or agents to find homes. So like I am on the websites, on the customer-facing sites, and we build a lot of features that are focused on helping people find the perfect home that they want.
Is it fun or is it just, you know, it's a job and it's a good, you're in the right field of the future?
I definitely find it extremely satisfying. It has moments of fun, but it can also be extremely frustrating when you're working on a problem that can be sometimes extremely difficult. But
that's nice. I've been frustrated on the other side of the computer. So it's frustrating for you too.
It definitely has its moments, yeah.
Sherry, you teach folks who are learning to code as a second career, as you did as well?
Yes.
What's different about later learners? If anything, you know, you have your digital natives and the people who just say, maybe I'll switch careers. It's all about the coding.
Later learners often come into it a little bit intimidated. I've also taught younger people who did not already spend 10 years in marketing, and they are not as nervous about it. Later learners have heard that coding is hard, that software is hard, and they're not sure they're smart enough. Or, you know, when you're 35 and you've been good at something for 5 years already, starting over and being really bad at something is really hard on your ego. So,
you know, thank you for mentioning smart. Do I have to be a whiz kid to get into coding, or should I not get into coding unless I'm really super good at, I don't know, math or logic?
I don't know. Does anyone ever think they're really smart enough to do something hard?
Good question.
I think that being good at logic is important. One of the prerequisites, a program I was working with was trying to recruit people who had no technical experience to learn. And one of the measures we came up with that might indicate future success with writing software was knitting. Absolutely. If you can follow a knitting pattern to make like a sweater or a complicated hat, you have a pretty good idea of how to execute a bunch of small steps to end up with a bigger project. And that's what a lot of software is. You know, your team has an idea for a big feature you're going to write, and you need to break it down into smaller steps to get there. The actual writing the code, you know, remembering where the semicolons go, that's not that hard. But thinking about it logically and breaking things down into smaller pieces is the majority of the job. If you're good at that, you'll do well.
Logically, but also creatively. I mean, knitting, you are thinking of, you're being creative, I hope, making something beautiful.
Yeah. And
do you feel that way?
I absolutely feel that way about software. I would not call it art, but I would absolutely call it a craft. You are creating something, which is so fun, so rewarding.
Lissa, you said that the most successful person in your software boot camp came from theater?
Yeah, she did. She was the one who I think arguably had some of the best projects all of her projects were they were very well designed and very interactive and intuitive. And I think she actually ended up going to a company that does software for children.
Software for children. So coding, I should think of it as just as potentially creative as any other field is potentially creative or not, depending on what you put into it. I mean, is it like at that level now that coding is not just, go do it. If you want to eat regularly, go do a bunch of numbers, whether you like it or not. It's just not that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the key with software development is there's never any one right way to do anything. So there is a lot of leeway to debate with people, to find new ways of approaching things. There is a lot of creativity that's involved with it. And especially being able to think kind of outside the box for solving problems is a huge benefit.
And Sherry, you're nodding. You're a photographer.
I am, and I know so many people in software who have backgrounds in theater or fine arts. It's so funny. But
why do you think that is?
You know, as my mom so astutely pointed out when we talked about me going to art school, it's kind of hard to make a living in fine arts.
Oh, well, there's that connection.
But software is creative, and people want to pay you for it, which is really awesome. But also, if you're on... Also, it's interacting with users often. And if you love theater, you love, you know, making people have a reaction, entertaining people. And if you enjoy that, then maybe you're going to enjoy building web applications that are fun to use or easy to use or make people's lives more interesting.
Yeah. And that's all this is probably obvious to somebody who's not my age, you know, that of course, web applications, you use them for fun and all the time. And I'm still stuck in this kind of Unix, like ones and zeros and other stuff. What about someone who is a people person? This is also another maybe outdated stereotype of coding is that you're alone in a basement. What about that, Lissa?
I think it's definitely important to have strong social skills as a programmer. You know, you don't work by yourself in a lot of cases. You work on a team of people. And it's constant interaction with everybody. You know, I don't work sitting by myself in a tiny dark little room. I work in a room filled with all of my team members. And every single day, you know, you have to talk with your designer and with your product manager about the way your project is going. You have to communicate with your fellow developers. You know, when I want to deploy my code into production, it doesn't just happen. It has to go through reviews from other developers, from my teammates. I have to talk with them about the decisions that I made. It's a very interactive process.
Agreed, Sherry?
Agreed, yeah. Even if you're writing software for a machine that's going to bend wrought iron into cool shapes, you know, there's still going to be a human somewhere that pushes buttons and cleans that machine when it's not being used and will end up interacting with your software somehow. You never really get away from working with other people.
Can the average coder look forward to coming up with out-of-the-box ideas that express their personality and get implemented? Or is the reality that there's a group of people who are more the, I don't know, the brainstormer types, and they tell the coders how to implement their ideas, then it's real specialized?
I think the room for innovation and individual ideas depends on the kind of environment you're working in. But in general, I make my own decisions about the code I'm going to write. So there is always some level of personal decision making.
You think you could teach me to code?
Yeah.
Given what I've displayed over the last several minutes. Deep silence that I respect. I accept
yes,
your judgment.
Nodding. Absolutely.
So when coders equal to those people who think coding and they think Amazon, what are some of the jobs that we're overlooking? Because these days, like what field doesn't use computers in some way? So what should we be thinking about?
I think technology touches our lives in so many different ways that it's just in places you don't even think about. Like, for example, a lot of refrigerators have screens on them these days. Somebody programmed that. You have, you know, locks on your front door that can be unlocked with your smartphone.
As a matter of fact, we're going to be talking about that in a moment. Have you heard of the Amazon key idea?
Yeah, I saw a few headlines.
Yeah, I'll pause there for any reaction you want to have to the idea of letting Amazon open your door and walk in. Mm. I'm getting a face from Lissa. No, not into it. Mm. Sherry, wow, two thumbs down. Why do you say that?
You know, we were just having this conversation before the show about how, as programmers, we tend to not have a lot of Internet of Things in our houses.
Really? That's interesting. Tell me about that.
My house is extremely unconnected.
Really? Why do you think that is?
We've written software. We know that even the best software has bugs and security vulnerabilities. It happens.
Privacy concerns.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. So the people who are writing the software know that I should not be using software to the level that corporations would like me to? Is that fair?
I think it really depends on the product and your use of it.
Yeah.
And the relative risks, right? Like the risk of me having a connected refrigerator, if things go wrong there, my milk will spoil. If things go wrong with an internet-connected lock on my front door, my cat might get stolen. It's a much bigger risk.
Your mind went to your cat. Interesting.
My priority is straight.
So give me a worst case scenario. Here I am getting a chance to learn from you guys. What's something that you wish KUOW listeners knew about how software actually goes down? Or vulnerabilities, or I don't know. You tell me.
I think the biggest thing is that there are people writing this software, so nothing is ever going to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And most software systems are, at this point, huge. They're so complex. Even with large teams of really smart, really determined people working on them, it's almost impossible to catch every potential security vulnerability. There's a lot of really smart people on the other side looking for ways to exploit it as well.
Okay, so I interrupted you when you brought up internet opened doors, but you were on a roll. You talked about, you know, refrigerators, and I like that. So tell me, are there other jobs that I should be thinking about, as I said, beyond, oh, Amazon? You know, what other career possibilities should I have in mind?
I think one thing to remember, we think often about all software jobs being in software companies, but it's everywhere at this point. KUOW has a very nice website. Someone who writes code built that for you. And someone takes these shows and turns them into podcast recordings and distributes them somehow. Those are software jobs.
I like all of those people, by the way.
I bet they're
very
cool,
human,
right?
And cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Another thing.
I'll pass
to think
on
about,
the compliment.
Another thing to think about is that software and technology isn't just powered by developers. There are a lot of other people who go into making these products. There are product managers. There are designers. And a lot of these people don't necessarily have coding backgrounds or necessarily ever even need to code, but they're still as big a part of the industry as a developer.
Do you wish we'd even stop talking about tech bros?
Definitely.
Tell me about that.
I think it's a very unfortunate stereotype that affects the attitude of people in the industry, and I also think it can have a big effect on people who are thinking about going into the industry. I took a programming class at UW when I was in college, and in a class of 30 people, I was the only woman in that class. And that can have a very serious effect on people.
So you're saying the tech bro stereotype is accurate, but you wish that weren't the PR?
I don't think it's accurate. I certainly know at Redfin, I've never worked with or encountered anybody there that could fit that stereotype. But I have met people like that in the industry. So I think it's really on companies to build the kind of culture that they want.
What does tech bro mean to you? I should make sure we're all talking about the same thing.
Oh, it means the kind of person who's been coding since they were, you know, 2 months old. And so everybody else, you know, just isn't a real engineer. You know, it means that if you don't, you know, drink beer every day or, you know, I don't know, Mountain Dew and eat Doritos or something like that, then you're not a real engineer.
I think the concept of a tech bro is someone who's a gatekeeper, someone who has kind of limited life experience and doesn't value skills that they don't possess. I also wish we could talk a little bit less about tech bros, because I feel like the villainization of them means that those people who do fall into that category start to get this us versus them mindset and are never going to get cooler, right? Because that criticism makes them, I don't know, more defensive. But I wish they were cooler.
Do you see Seattle culture as having gone to tech bro, or is that a caricature?
I think with Amazon especially, we're seeing a huge influx of people in Seattle who are men who are relatively young, fresh out of college, have made real good tech money their entire working career, no matter how short it is. And who want a particular set of services and entertainment options in their city and have a pretty large economic impact. And so they're getting the things they want, which is pushing out options that different demographics might enjoy.
I'm talking with Sherry Allen, a sculptor and an engineer who teaches coding, and Lissa Walzer, former biologist, now a developer at Redfin. So just to finally turn to the future, I've got these three kids, fifth grade, second grade. Do you think that I ought to make sure they know how to code?
I think it's something that you should consider introducing them to. And then if they take a natural interest in it, encourage that. But I don't think that everybody has to know how to code.
I would agree. I think an equal argument could be made that efficient management of fresh water through a city and home is crucial to our modern society, and so everyone should learn plumbing, right? Uh-huh. It's absurd. Not everyone needs to learn to code, but coding is super fun, super rewarding, and yeah, introduce everyone to it, and if they like it, go for it, and if they don't, well, hey, plumbing is really cool.
True. Yeah, and speaking of someone who'll always have work. So then is it, final question, is it part of the problem that more people are learning to code, or is it part of a solid defense against the downsides of, you know, bad coding, bad algorithms? How do you feel about this? You talked about some of the opportunities for abuse. Do you wish that people who were not into, who don't think of themselves as coders, would become that way, and the scene would change?
I think there's a lot of research showing that more diverse teams writing software write quantitatively better software. So yes, I absolutely think more people getting into it who have different backgrounds improve the quality of the output. I also wish there were a lot more really awesome career options that were as cool and had as good of job security as writing software.
By the way, Sherry, you work with an organization called Unloop. Its mission is building the pipeline from prison to tech. Tell me about that.
Man, they are so cool. They started by doing just one day introduction to robotics workshops inside of prisons, and I've volunteered at several of those, and they're incredibly cool. One guy I talked to there said he was so excited. He was an older guy. He was so excited to be learning this. He had been wanting to do more technology learning, and he had been in prison for quite a long time, and the last opportunity he had to learn anything technology-wise was to learn DOS, because that was required for the word processing program that he was learning.
DOS is the, that was pre-Windows, right, from the 80s and before.
Yep. That's how long it had been since there had been an opportunity for folks in that facility to learn anything about technology.
Well, does tech not have the same barriers for people with criminal records as other sectors do?
Well, once I started volunteering with Unloop, I started asking at job fairs what companies' policies were about felony convictions. And I got a lot of recruiters looking real nervous and not having an answer. But what's really nice about tech skills, especially web skills, right, is if you can build websites or web applications, you can be self-employed. Everyone needs a website. The pizza place on the corner needs a website. If you have those skills, you can support yourself. And tech really prides itself on being a meritocracy, right? Anyone who can do the work is welcome. You don't necessarily need a fancy degree. You don't need a pedigree. You just need to be able to do the work. And so there are a lot of companies who are more open to people with, you know, more unfortunate backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. What did you two think of the that the whole flapper on the Google engineer, you know, the memo writing about whether women were suited for, I'm getting a major eye roll from Sherry. You have a very expressive face. I really enjoy
watching
it. A face
for radio.
You.
Thank you.
yes. What did you think of that whole conversation?
I feel like that is just emblematic of why people get so upset about tech bros, you know, like, really, really? In this year of our Lord, 2017, you are going to publicly, in a professional setting, say that half the population is just biologically unsuited to a particular thing. Like, come on, buddy. And then be upset when people react poorly to that. What the heck?
How representative of in your industry is that?
I mean, I just want to go back a little bit and say the biggest thing is that I feel like a lot of these stereotypes and roles get pushed on girls from an extremely early age. And so at this point, I don't even think we can say what's biologically kind of suited and what's not, because these choices are being imprinted on girls from the time they're infants practically.
Mm-hmm.
So we just don't know what is, you know, like what's biology and what's just conditioning at this point.
So are you finding barriers for yourself, gender-based barriers in your work, do you think?
I've encountered that less so, but I'm also very fortunate to be at a company that has, you know, a woman CTO and has a large number of women engineers at the company. I have occasionally heard different stories from other women.
Yeah, I've absolutely encountered sexism, but you know, I switched to tech later in life. I've worked in restaurants. I've worked in retail. Have you ever been in a restaurant kitchen? There's a lot worse sexism there. Man, it's nasty. What I like about tech is that we're having these conversations and we're trying to do better. And I wish that that was not so rare, but man, we're trying.
Hey, thanks for coming in and telling us. But you know, the premise of this was someone thinking, well, geez, maybe coding is the only thing I got to do, and how should I feel about that? And you've just really fleshed it out for me and for us in thinking about what would a career in coding and software look like. So thanks for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Sherry Allen, an engineer. She teaches coding. Lissa Walzer, a developer at Redfin. Great to talk with you.
Thank you.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. We were talking about that Amazon key. And we'll come back to that subject in just a moment. It's KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. As we were just discussing, Amazon is everywhere, as you know, in Seattle. Now Amazon wants to come closer inside your house.
With Amazon Key, you can get your packages delivered just inside your door. You can track your delivery with real-time notifications, watch the delivery happening live, or review a video of the delivery after it's complete.
This would happen if you buy a special lock and a security camera from Amazon. Washington Post opinion columnist Christine Emba calls this idea Silicon Valley at its most out of touch. And you don't even have to be in Silicon Valley, apparently. Christine, welcome to KUOW.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Why is Amazon out of touch with this?
I think that you can tell that something is a little bit off with this idea when you look at the reaction that Amazon Key has gotten from kind of anyone who's seen it. But I actually think that it's out of touch in a larger sense. It's sort of representative of this Silicon Valley philosophy that a lot of these companies have, which really misunderstands sort of the hierarchy of human goods, you know, what things matter to people and how much. It assumes that convenience, you know, the convenience of having the delivery person let themselves in and leave the package inside your door, outweighs kind of anything else. And that's not really the case.
I saw you write that some of these convenience service ideas are, quote, things that I, a 25-year-old man, wish that I could still get my mother to do for me.
Yes, I did. I think that's something that's kind of common in a lot of these new apps and inventions that are coming out, right? It's like, oh, well, somebody will shop for your groceries and create a receipt or a recipe and then send it directly to you. Or a robot will deliver your food by hand. Or there's an app for somebody to do your laundry for you. There are all these conveniences that, you know, most people could do themselves, but don't want to.
Well, why should I want to? I love conveniences.
So that's also a good question. I think that there are some conveniences that are great. I mean, I also love convenience. I can be as lazy as anyone else. But some of them are kind of downright dehumanizing. So I'm thinking of, you know, these things that, for example, actually I talked about the proposal for Bodega, the sort of personal vending machine that was supposed to put mom and pop shops out of business. That was floated, you know, a couple of weeks ago and promptly sunk. It's convenient, I guess, to be able to go and get your necessaries from a vending machine, but you never actually get to talk to any other people. Actually, it turns out a lot of humans value, you know, being able to walk down the street to interact with, you know, a mom and pop store owner, to come in contact with the diversity of their neighborhood or to build community with the people around them. It's convenient, but so, it's not really good for us.
You think the bodega idea was sunk because people said, no, I want more walking and and talking to strangers who are store owners. That's what people like?
So I don't think that's, well, I think the uproar was first caused by how kind of obviously and terribly they stated their product. You know, they kind of said, we plan to put mom and pop shops out of business, which just sounds mean.
Yeah.
And then they were kind of taking over the idea of the bodega from, you know, that's a specific term. It's used kind of in specific cultures to denote a certain thing. And they basically just tried to gentrify it out of existence. And people reacted to that. But I do think that there's something about the idea of community and neighborhood institutions that people actually still really value. And that's what they were trying to get rid of.
I'm trying to figure out how much I value that interaction, because I can think of both circumstances where I have a pleasant chat with a store employee who I have, especially if I have seen them before. And I really do like that. And I like to banter with people. And then on the other hand, there really are times when I just want to be in that automated checkout line because I don't want to have that same, lighthearted small talk. I don't want to do it. Am I a bad human?
Not at all. You're totally right. Actually, in my piece, I talk about, you know, going to the self-checkout counter because I don't really enjoy making eye contact with a judgmental cashier when I'm, you know, like buying 5 pounds of candy. But the thing about, you know, living in a kind of frictionless world where you don't interact with anyone is that it's frictionless, but you're also not touching anyone, which sounds kind of weird, but bear with me. You know, there's something about interacting with other people that, you know, builds solidarity. You know, it helps kind of form the person you are, and you do build relationships, which I think we're beginning to realize are really important to human happiness. And obviously that's your friends and family and that sort of thing. But yes, the people who, you know, live and work around you every day count, and you want to make sure that they still exist in some way in your life.
So is your skepticism about this Amazon Key idea more about your enjoying a quick small talk exchange with a person who drops off a package, or is it more about, I don't want to let a stranger into my house, even if I do have a camera on them?
Yeah, great question. So I think that the idea of interacting with others is an important one, but Amazon Key is kind of horrifying to me for a sort of different reason. You know, going back to the idea of, you know, the human hierarchy of goods, what we value and what we don't, again, Amazon Key thinks that we value convenience really highly, but I actually don't value convenience over, you know, my safety or my right to privacy or my general ability not to let strangers into my home when I'm not there. So I find Key more frightening just because it's creepy and it is unsafe, or at least it feels so to me.
Well, first of all, in fairness, there's also the not wanting my package to be stolen or rained on. But meanwhile, we do give up a lot of information to companies, and we're basically saying we trust them, even if we don't. You know, we may not say we trust them, but we demonstrate it every day by giving personal information. Are you sure we won't just get used to the idea that, yeah, I trust Amazon with a lot, including letting people in and out of my house? It goes fine.
Yeah, totally. One of the things I think was startling about Amazon Key and why there's so much talk about it is that it makes it really obvious how much control we're giving over to Amazon, the company. Like, you're letting a human into the place that you live, someone you don't know. And that's just kind of more eye-opening and surprising than the idea of, oh, I'm carrying around this smartphone, which, yeah, is maybe tracking my location, but I'm not thinking about it. Mm. Or, you know, I'm talking to Alexa, which is listening to me, but doesn't seem that obvious. This is really in your face or in your house. But it also does seem like something that we could very easily get used to, in the same way that we've gotten used to many other inventions that seemed kind of ridiculous in the first instance.
You mentioned Airbnb.
Yeah, Airbnb is the one that I think of the most often because it's a really weird product. It's a really weird idea. Like, oh, I'm going to leave my house and invite strangers to come in and, like, have sex in my bed while I'm gone. That's pretty weird, and yet we're all doing it now.
That was vivid. I hadn't seen that in the advertising copy for Airbnb, but I suppose that is a feature of home share. Christine Emba, it's been great to talk with you about Amazon Key and so much more. Christine writes for the Washington Post opinion section. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for listening to today's episode of The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Talk to you tomorrow.